Greetings, Saints of the Most High. Welcome to Word Study with Brother Hebert. This is part 18 of Devil, Satan, Serpent. You can follow along with the article by going to www.thinkoutsidethebeast.com. Devil, Satan, Serpent can be found on the main menu. In our last message, we saw how Acts 4 and 5 present a striking contrast between the faithful and the false, between Barnabas, a vessel of honor, and Ananias and Sapphira, vessels of dishonor. Their deception wasn't caused by some external satanic force, but by the devil within, the carnal mind filled with pride, greed, and hypocrisy. Just like Cain, they were given the opportunity to rule over sin, but they chose otherwise. This ties directly into the greater biblical pattern. Abel and Cain, Jacob and Esau, Barnabas and Ananias, those who walk in truth and those who fall through deceit. And at the center of it all is the heart. The heart that seeks Jesus and is kingdom conscious is given understanding and walks in the light. But the heart that chases the world becomes self-conscious, given over to delusion and walks in darkness. We continue in Romans 16:17-24. It contains the Apostle Paul's final exhortations and greetings in his letter to the Roman Israelites. In these verses, Paul warns against divisive individuals and offers a promise of victory over Satan. Romans 16:17. Now I beseech you, brethren, mark them which cause divisions and offenses contrary to the doctrine which you have learned, and avoid them. Paul commands separation from them, using strong language. Avoid them. Their deceptions are smooth speech, flattering words, and manipulative rhetoric. Like our ancient patriarchs in Genesis, Paul admonishes his Christian kinsmen not to go down the holy mountain to the children of Cain. Verse 18, for they that are such serve not our Master Jesus Christ, but their own belly, and by good words and fair speeches deceive the hearts of the simple. Philippians 3:19, whose end is destruction, whose God is their belly, and whose glory is in their shame, who mind earthly things. 1 Timothy 6:5, perverse disputings of men of corrupt minds, and destitute of the truth, supposing that gain is godliness. From such withdraw yourself. These false teachers are self-serving, aiming for personal gain, and lack divine credentials. They sow discord through persuasive yet misleading speech, leading believers astray. The early congregations faced threats from Judaizing teachers who sought to impose Jewish laws on the converts and introduce doctrines inconsistent with the gospel, aiming to create factions and draw followers after themselves. There were probably even some well-meaning people trying to be teachers, but were not divinely called to teach. This is the problem with today's preachers, the blind leading the blind. Paul acknowledges the Romans' commendable faith and urges them to continue discerning good from evil, maintaining their integrity. Verse 19, for your obedience is come abroad unto all men. I am glad, therefore, on your behalf. But yet I would have you wise unto that which is good, and simple concerning evil. And the God of peace shall bruise Satan under your feet shortly. The grace of our Master Jesus Christ be with you. Amen. Paul is telling these Israelite Romans that Satan will be crushed under their feet. Shortly. This must be a reference to 70 AD and the destruction of Jerusalem. This is a prophecy. He is identifying the Jewish ruling class, the Edomite Pharisees, and that they will be crushed. Genesis 3:15. This prophecy came true in 70 AD when the Romans, the Zara branch of Israelites, destroyed the temple under General Titus. This broke the power of the Edomites, and many fled to Caesarea, while the Catholic Church gained power and the children of Israel migrated through the Caucasus Mountains, where we get the word Caucasian, and settled in the wilderness of Europe and colonized the nations of Europe and eventually America. Verse 20 is linked to Genesis 3:15, the first prophecy of Satan's defeat.
He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel.
Satan's defeat at the cross. Luke 10:19, Jesus grants authority over evil. I have given you authority to trample on snakes and scorpions and to overcome all the power of the enemy. God granting believers dominion over their adversary, leading to victory over all agents of evil. 1 John 3:8, Christ's mission to destroy the devil's work. The reason the Son of God appeared was to destroy the devil's work. An assurance of victory over Satan's attempts to sow discord, emphasizing that God, the author of peace, will subdue the adversary. I see individual power through Jesus Christ over internal and external adversaries. The meaning of shortly, entakos. Greek breakdown. En, G 1722, in or within. Takos, G 5034, meaning speed, quickness, imminence. Together means swiftly, soon, without delay, in a short time. Common interpretations of shortly. Imminent victory over false teachers. Paul may be assuring the Roman believers that God will swiftly deal with the divisive individuals, verses 17 and 18, who are undermining the faith. This points to quick resolution within the church rather than a distant future event. The phrase en takos appears in 6 places in the New Testament, always meaning something will happen quickly, soon, or suddenly. Luke 18:8, He will avenge them speedily. God's justice is swift. Acts 12:7, The angel of the Lord appeared suddenly. Immediate divine action. Acts 22:18, Make haste and get out of Jerusalem quickly. Urgency of departure. Romans 16:20, The God of peace will soon crush Satan under your feet. A rapid, decisive victory. Revelation 1:1, Things which must shortly come to pass. Imminence of prophetic events. Revelation 22:6, Things which must shortly come to pass. Fulfillment is near. The word takos, G 5034, speed, swiftness, appears 8 times, reinforcing the idea of divine intervention happening suddenly or soon. Luke 18:8, God's justice will come swiftly. Acts 12:7, angelic deliverance is immediate. Acts 22:18, urgency to leave Jerusalem. Romans 16:20, God will quickly act against Satan. 1 Timothy 3:14, Paul hopes to visit Timothy soon. Revelation 1:1, prophetic events will soon take place. Revelation 22:6, the fulfillment of God's plan is imminent. Revelation 22:7, Christ's return is swift. Key observations from these occurrences. Takos always implies certainty and urgency. It does not always mean immediately, but when it happens, it will be swift. The meaning depends on context, sometimes referring to divine judgment, prophetic events, or personal urgency. Immediate, a near or quick victory over false teachers in the church. The early assemblies experienced deliverance from opposition, persecutors, and false teachers. Historically, the 70 AD destruction of Jerusalem as God's judgment. The priestcraft and temple rituals of the Pharisees and Sadducees was broken and Jerusalem destroyed in 70 AD, crushing Satan's head. This event is seen as God's judgment on the Jewish authorities who opposed and persecuted early Christians. Ongoing. Spiritual triumphs through Jesus Christ's power in believers. It reassures believers not to lose heart. God is already defeating the forces of evil in their lives when they walk in the way and obey Him. Remember, Paul opens up with commending them for their obedience. Final. The ultimate destruction of Satan at Christ's return. The final crushing will happen at the second coming, Revelation 20:10. Like in Revelation 1:1, shortly means imminent from God's perspective, aligning with His divine plan. Some interpret the shortly to be a reference to Revelation 20, 1-3, which refers to the time during the Byzantine Empire. For roughly a millennium, European Jewish communities faced systemic exclusion, ghettoization, and social restrictions due to religious, economic, and political factors. The ghetto system was not uniform across all regions, but common themes included forced segregation and legal discrimination. Basically, following God's laws of segregation, fellowship, covenants, and community guidelines. Unbelievers, heathen, and aliens are not permitted in the commonwealth of Israelite communities. Early Christian restrictions, the 5th through 10th centuries. Theodosius II, 438 AD, issued the Theodosian Code, which placed legal restrictions on Jewish civic rights. Church councils, the 4th to the 9th centuries, including those at Clermont, 535, and Toledo, 7th century, prohibited Jews from holding public office, marrying Christians, or proselytizing. In Visigothic Spain in the 7th century, Jews were forced to convert to Christianity or face exile or enslavement. Under Charlemagne in the 8th and 9th century, Jews enjoyed limited protection, but later Carolingian rulers imposed restrictions on land ownership and trade. Growth of Jewish ghettos, the 11th to the 15th centuries. The First Crusade, 1096, led to massacres of Jewish communities, viper dens, especially in the Rhineland, Germany. Lateran Council IV, 1215, under Pope Innocent III, required Jews to wear identifying badges and restricted them from certain professions. Jewish ghettos emerged across Europe, particularly in Venice, 1516, the first officially designated ghetto, Frankfurt, 1462, the Judengasse, Jewish street, confined Jews to a segregated area, Rome, 1555, Pope Paul IV created the Roman ghetto, restricting Jews to crowded, walled quarters. Economic and social restrictions. Banned from land ownership. Instead, Jews integrated into professions like money lending, trade, and medicine. They were often taxed heavily and used as scapegoats for economic or political problems. Expulsions. England, 1290, expelled by Edward I. France, 1306 and 1394, expelled twice under Philip IV and Charles VI. Spain, 1492, the Alhambra Decree forced Jews to convert, leave, or face death. Tensions and persecutions. The Black Death, 1347 to 1351. Jews were accused of poisoning wells, leading to massacres and expulsions. Blood libels and host desecration accusations fueled pogroms, violent anti-Jewish riots. Forced disputations, public debates in which rabbis were compelled to defend Judaism against Christian theologians, example, Disputation of Paris, 1240. Renaissance and Reformation shifts, the 15th to the 16th century. Jewish life remained restricted, but some economic opportunities increased in places like the Ottoman Empire, Poland, and Italy. The Protestant Reformation, 16th century, brought mixed responses, with Martin Luther initially supporting Jews, but later writing anti-Jewish tracts. Martin Luther's change of mind on the Jews. Early Sympathy, 1523. Luther initially defended Jews against Catholic persecution, believing they rejected Christ because of Catholic corruption. He wrote that Jesus Christ was born a Jew, urging kindness, hoping they would convert to his purified Christianity. Shift to hostility, 1530s to 1540s. When Jews adamantly rejected Christ despite the Reformation, Luther grew frustrated. He saw their continued denial of Jesus as willful rebellion, not ignorance. He also accused them of deception, blasphemy, usury, and undermining Christianity. Harsh Condemnation, 1543. In On the Jews and Their Lies, he called for destroying synagogues, banning Jewish books, expelling Jews, and forcing them into labor. He saw them as spiritually blind, deceitful, and enemies of Jesus Christ. Reasons for his change. Jewish refusal to convert. Even after Reformation, they rejected Christ. Perceived deception and subversion. He accused them of blasphemy, financial exploitation, and false teachings. Political and social pressure. As Protestants sought religious unity, Jews were seen as an obstacle. Napoleon and the Emancipation of the Jews, circa 1800. During the late 18th and early 19th centuries, Napoleon Bonaparte played a significant role in Jewish emancipation across Europe. Before his rise, Jews were segregated in ghettos, restricted from citizenship, and subjected to heavy taxation and legal discrimination. Napoleon's policies dismantled many of these barriers, granting Jews civil rights and integrating them into broader society. Early Reforms, 1797 to 1804. During the French Revolution, 1789 to 1799, France became the first European nation to grant Jews full citizenship, 1791. As Napoleon expanded his empire, 1797 to 1804, he abolished Jewish ghettos in Italy, Germany, and Poland, freeing Jewish communities from centuries of forced segregation. His proclamation in Italy, 1797, declared that Jews would be treated as equal citizens, allowing them to own property, enter professions, and serve in the military. The Great Sanhedrin, 1806 to 1807. Napoleon sought to assimilate Jews into French society while maintaining their religious traditions. In 1806, he convened the Grand Sanhedrin, a Jewish assembly modeled after the ancient Sanhedrin, to answer questions about Jewish loyalty, intermarriage, and legal matters. The assembly affirmed that Jews could be both loyal citizens of France and faithful to their religious heritage. Mixed Policies and Restrictions, 1808. While Napoleon initially championed Jewish rights, he later issued the infamous Decree, 1808, in response to backlash from conservative French elites. This decree temporarily restricted Jewish financial activities, such as money lending, but still maintained their legal status as equal citizens. Lasting Impact. Napoleon's policies spread Jewish emancipation across Europe, influencing reforms in Prussia, Austria, and beyond. Even after his death in 1815, many of his legal changes remained, paving the way for full Jewish integration in European society in the 19th century. The Rothschild banking dynasty, symbolized by the red shield, Rothschild, in German, emerged in the 18th century and became one of the most powerful financial forces in modern history. Their influence is linked to the global banking system, a key part of the Mystery Babylon financial empire referenced in Revelations 17 and 18. Origins of the Rothschild dynasty, 18th century. Meyer Amschel Rothschild, 1744 to 1812, a Jewish banker in Frankfurt, Germany, founded the family empire. He sent his five sons to establish banking houses in major European capitals, Frankfurt, Amschel, London, Nathan, Paris, James, Vienna, Salomon, and Naples, Karl. They developed international financial networks, enabling them to control the flow of money across Europe. Key strategies for financial domination. War financing. Funded both sides of major conflicts, including the Napoleonic Wars and the U.S. Civil War. Central banking influence. Helped establish central banks in multiple nations, allowing governments to become dependent on debt-based currency. Government bonds and speculation. Manipulated markets through insider knowledge, such as Nathan Rothschild's infamous control of British war bonds after the Battle of Waterloo, 1815. Control over precious metals and currencies. Played a major role in the rise of the gold standard, consolidating global wealth. 19th to 20th century expansion. The London and Paris branches became dominant in European finance, funding the British Empire, Vatican projects, and global industrialization. Helped establish the Federal Reserve, 1913, securing control over United States monetary policy. Played a role in the creation of the World Bank and International Monetary Fund, the IMF, ensuring influence over global economies. The Rothschilds and Mystery Babylon. Revelation chapter 17 and 18 describe Mystery Babylon as a global financial power that controls kings and nations through commerce and debt. The Rothschild network aligns with many prophetic attributes. Wealth beyond measure, Revelation 18:3. Influence over governments and merchants, Revelation 18:9 and 15. Control over global trade and banking, Revelation 18:11-13. Ties to secretive elite organizations, Freemasonry, Bilderberg Group, etc. Their influence extends into geopolitics, controlling wars, currency values, and global wealth distribution. Many believe the modern banking system, dominated by Rothschild-affiliated institutions, fulfills this role. Jewish expulsions throughout history. Early expulsions, 70 AD, Roman destruction of Jerusalem and Second Temple, mass dispersion. 135 AD, the Bar Kokhba revolt, crushed, Jews banned from Jerusalem. 415 AD, Jews expelled from Alexandria, Egypt, by Saint Cyril. 629 AD, Byzantine Emperor Heraclius expels Jews from Jerusalem. Medieval expulsions, 1000 to 1500 AD. 1096 to 1099, First Crusade massacres Jews in Rhineland, Germany. 1182, France expels Jews under Philip II, but allows return in 1198. 1290, England expels Jews under King Edward I, Edict of Expulsion. 1306 and 1394, France expels Jews twice under Philip IV and Charles VI. 1348 to 1351, Black Death massacres lead to Jewish expulsions across Europe. 1492, Spain expels all Jews under Ferdinand and Isabella, Alhambra Decree. 1496 to 1497, Portugal and Navarre follow Spain's example, forcing conversion or exile. Early modern expulsions, 1500 to 1800 AD. 1569-1593, Pope Pius V expels Jews from many Italian states. 1648-1657, Cossack massacres, Khmelnytsky uprising, drive Jews from Ukraine. 1744-1781, Austria and Bohemia expel Jews under Maria Theresa. Modern expulsions, 1800 to present. 1881 to 1906, Russian pogroms drive Jews from Russia and Ukraine. 1933 to 1945, Germany expels Jews. Jews in Germany brought in political factions of communists and socialists. The government printed excessive currency, leading to hyperinflation. Social and cultural decay, the 1920s. Berlin became known for its extreme decadence, with a rise in prostitution, cabarets, open homosexuality, and drug use. Pornography, transvestitism, and sexual experimentation flourished, especially in Berlin's nightlife. The arts and media became highly progressive, with movements like Dadaism and Expressionism rejecting tradition. Jewish influence in media and finance was criticized by nationalists, as many prominent figures in banking, publishing, and entertainment were of Jewish descent. Moral conservatives saw the Weimar era as cultural degeneracy, calling it un-German. The same thing has happened here in America and all the white nations, hasn't it? The pattern of displacement, return, and further expulsion has shaped Jewish history for over 2,500 years. So why? Why were they kept out of Christian society for 1,000 years, kicked out of countries time and time again, rejected and persecuted? Because they were created by God as vessels fit for wrath and destruction. Jesus said, "Wherefore, by their fruits you shall know them." Drug culture and rock music. Jews invented the drug culture movement and rock music of the 1960s to encourage teenagers to rebel against their parents and destroy traditional values. Ownership of the medical and pharmaceutical system. Jews own and control the medical and pharmaceutical industries, and they use this control to suppress natural remedies and keep people sick for profit. Coronavirus pandemic. Jews are behind the COVID-19 pandemic and control various organizations and industries related to healthcare and media. Occult symbolism and numerology. Jews use specific numbers, symbols, signs, and logos in various aspects of society, including entertainment, corporate logos, and news media, as part of their occult practices. Freemasonry is a Jewish institution, and its members are being used for dark and evil purposes. Jews founded Satanist movements and create alternate theories and philosophies to lead people away from the truth. Jews are behind the push to remove American and European history and fund protests and pass anti-American and anti-Christian laws. School system. Jews created the current school system, which does not teach analytical thinking skills and encourages children to accept the status quo without questioning authority. Vaccines and chemicals in food. Jews created toxic vaccines and chemicals in processed foods, which dumb down children and make them easier to manipulate. Ownership of corporations. Jews own several corporations and companies, including Monsanto and Bayer, and are responsible for legalizing poison in food. Pornographic industry. Jews brought about the pornography industry, and many porn stars are Jewish. pedophilia, and human trafficking. Jews are involved in pedophilia, human trafficking, and child sex murder ritual blood drinking. Hollywood and Holocaust. Jews own Hollywood and produce films about the Holocaust in order to perpetuate the lie. White genocide. Jews created the United Nations to protect themselves while genociding the white race, the Boer farmers in South Africa, and the Palestinians as an example. Racial integration and race mixing. Jews are behind racial integration, diversity, open borders, and race mixing, which they themselves allege is part of a plan to annihilate the white race. Racial hate and tensions. Jews instigate racial tension and promote interracial marriage to hasten the process of creating a universal brotherhood of nations. Destruction of Christianity. Jews have destroyed Christianity by promoting the concept of Judeo-Christianity.
Just believe.
Oh, I'm saved.
Wars in third world countries. Jews create wars in third world countries and use images of dead children to manipulate people into allowing refugees into their countries. First Amendment rights. Jews are making the laws to take away First Amendment rights and control social media platforms to censor information. Second Amendment rights. Jews are making the laws to take away Second Amendment rights and disarm citizens. Abortion. Jews legalized abortion and pushed for various forms of birth control, encouraging a lifestyle of casual sex and a decline in commitment. Social justice movements. Jews are disproportionately involved in social justice movements, particularly in the field of whiteness studies, which focuses on concepts such as white guilt and white privilege. Kosher taxes. Jews are extorting non-Jewish consumers through hidden taxes on packaged and canned goods, with the money going to Jewish organizations. Gay and transgender agenda. Jews are wholly responsible for the gay and transgender agenda. Androgyny is a Jewish practice. Jewish presidents. Several U.S. presidents and other politicians have Jewish blood and were placed into their positions by the Jewish elite. Over 80% of politicians are Ashkenazi Jews and dual citizens. ABC agencies. The ABC agencies, various organizations and government agencies, are founded and run by Jews. Now maybe you can see why God wanted the cursed Canaanite and Edomite nations destroyed. But we let humanism and rebellion take hold and went our own way and allowed them into our midst. And as God warned and prophesied unto us, they've become thorns in our sides. Exodus 23:33 warns that if the Canaanites remain, they will lead Israel into sin. Exodus 34:12-16 commands Israel not to make covenants or intermarry with them. Numbers 33:55 declares that if the nations are not driven out, they will become thorns in Israel's side. Deuteronomy 7:1-5 commands complete destruction to prevent idolatry. Deuteronomy 12:29-31 warns against adopting their detestable practices. Joshua 13:13 records that Israel did not drive out the Geshurites and Maacathites. Joshua 15:63, the Jebusites remained in Jerusalem. Joshua 16:10, the Canaanites were not expelled from Gezer. Joshua 17:12-13, various Canaanite strongholds remained. Judges 1:21-36 lists the tribes that failed to drive out the inhabitants. Judges 2:1-3, the angel of the Lord rebukes Israel, saying the nations will now be thorns in their sides. Judges 3:1-6, God leaves the nations as a test for Israel. Psalm 106:34-39 laments Israel's failure to destroy the wicked nations, leading to idolatry and sin. Matthew 13:24-30 and 36-43, the parable of the wheat and tares. The enemy, Satan, sin, sows tares, wicked people, among the wheat, God's people, and they grow together until the judgment. Matthew 16:6-12, Jesus warns about the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees, meaning their corrupt teachings. Luke 13:24-27, Jesus warns that some who claim to be part of God's people will be rejected for their iniquity. John 8:44, Jesus identifies certain leaders as being of their father, the devil, indicating their rejection of truth and their opposition to God's people. Acts 20:29-30, Paul warns that grievous wolves will enter the flock, corrupting the faith from within. 2 Corinthians 6:14-18, Paul commands believers to separate from unbelievers and not be unequally yoked. Galatians 5:9, a little leaven leavens the whole lump, warning against allowing corruption to spread. 2 Thessalonians 2:3-12, describes the mystery of iniquity and the coming of the man of sin, showing how the enemy works inside the church to deceive. 2 Timothy 3:1-9, Paul warns of wicked people infiltrating the faith, having a form of godliness but denying its power. Hebrews 12:15 warns against a root of bitterness springing up to trouble and defile many. Revelation 2:9-3:9, Jesus condemns those who say they are Judah but are not, calling them the synagogue of Satan. Revelation 18:4, God calls his people to come out of Babylon, warning them not to partake in her sins. These verses parallel the Old Testament warnings about allowing ungodly influences to remain, showing how corrupt people and false doctrines infiltrate and deceive God's people if not removed. Regarding the topic of incest among the Corinthians, 1 Corinthians 5:1, it is reported commonly that there is fornication among you, and such fornication as is not so much as named among the Gentiles, that one should have his father's wife. Paul states that it is widely reported, G 36:54, holos, meaning everywhere, that a severe case of fornication is happening in the congregation, indicating that the matter was notorious, not a secret. Fornication includes all illicit sex, including incest. Even if your father's wife is not your mother, she is still his property. Deuteronomy 22:30, 27:20, Leviticus 18:8, Ephesians 5:3. Reuben and Bilhah, Genesis 35:22 and 49:4. Reuben was stripped of his birthright for lying with his father's concubine. The specific sin, a man having his father's wife, is condemned even by pagan societies. Verse 2, And you are puffed up, and have not rather mourned, that he that had done this deed might be taken away from among you. Puffed up, meaning inflated with pride, spiritual complacency, tied to their misunderstanding of Christian liberty.
Oh, I'm saved.
Failure to mourn, as mourning for the dead, which a practicing sinner is. Lack of discipline, the offender should have been removed from fellowship, cast out. If an Israelite is unrepentant and will not change their ways, they are to be cast out of the congregation. The Corinthian congregation tolerated it instead of mourning and disciplining the offender. Matthew 18:15-17, Jesus instructs removing an unrepentant sinner. Deuteronomy 13:5 and 17:7, Israel was to purge evil from among them. Psalm 119:136, mourning over sin. Ephesians 5:11, have no fellowship with the unfruitful works of darkness, but rather reprove them. Revelation 2:20-23, Jezebel in Thyatira tolerated immorality, leading to judgment. Verse 5, For I verily, as absent in body, but present in spirit, have determined already, as though I were present, concerning him that has so done this deed. Paul, though physically absent, discerning the situation fully, exercises apostolic authority to pronounce judgment and discipline without delay. 2 Corinthians 10:8, Paul's authority to correct. John 20:23, the power to bind and loose sins in the assembly. Verse 4, in the name of our Master Jesus Christ, when you are gathered together, and my spirit with the power of our Master Jesus Christ, to deliver such an one unto Satan, for the destruction of the flesh, that the spirit may be saved in the day of the Master Jesus. Psalm 109:6, set you a wicked man over him, and let Satan stand at his right hand. When the wicked is cast out of society, or the congregation, they are without Yahweh's protection, and the adversaries of Christ will either consume him or prompt him to repent. The phrase, deliver to Satan, means to hand over the offender to Satan's domain, the secular world, removing him from the protective covering of the congregation. The purpose is not eternal damnation, but correction, allowing the individual to suffer physically or socially, losing status, wealth, or dignity, such as the prodigal son, Luke 15:16, leading to repentance. Satan is not a literal being, but a representation of the adversarial forces encountered outside the faith community. In 1 Corinthians 7:1-16, the Apostle Paul addresses questions from the Corinthian church regarding marriage, celibacy, and relationships between believers and unbelievers. 1 Corinthians 7:1, now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to join with a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Paul begins by acknowledging the Corinthian statement that it is good for a man not to touch a woman, suggesting a preference for celibacy. However, he recognizes the reality of human passions and advises marriage as a means to prevent sexual immorality and to maintain moral integrity. Verse 3, let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence, and likewise also the wife unto the husband. The wife has not power of her own body, but the husband, and likewise also the husband has not power of his own body, but the wife. Both partners have authority over each other's bodies, highlighting the importance of fulfilling conjugal duties to prevent temptation and maintain harmony within the marriage. Verse 5, defraud, or withdraw you not one the other, except it be with consent for a time, that you may give yourself to fasting and prayer, and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your self-control. The emphasis is on the importance of regular marital intimacy as a safeguard against moral failings, lack of self-control, and leading them into temptation. In verses 8 and 9, to the unmarried and widows, Paul suggests that remaining single, as he is, can be beneficial, especially considering the present circumstances of persecution. However, he concedes that if they lack self-control, it is better to marry than to struggle with burning passions. In verses 10 and 11, Paul reiterates the laws of divorce and underscores the sanctity and permanence of the marital bond. In verses 12 and 13, addressing marriages between believers and unbelievers, Paul advises that if the unbelieving spouse is willing to live with the believing partner, they should not divorce. This guidance aims to maintain marital unity and reflects the hope that the unbelieving spouse may come to faith through the believing partner's influence. Verse 14, Paul explains that the unbelieving spouse and their children are sanctified through the believing partner, meaning the marriage is recognized as holy because it is a form of positional sanctification, meaning the unbelieving spouse is set apart within the marriage covenant, benefiting from a unique proximity to the Christian faith and its blessings. This association creates an environment where the unbelieving partner is exposed to Christian values, potentially leading to their own faith journey. Verses 15 and 16 explains that if the unbelieving partner chooses to leave the marriage, the believer is not bound in such circumstances, as God has called believers to live in peace. In 2 Corinthians 2:1-11, Paul addresses the delicate situation of a member within the Corinthian church involved in the grievous misconduct mentioned in 1 Corinthians 5. Verses 5 through 10 focus on the community's response to the repentant offender, urging them to forgive him, noting that his punishment of ejection from the assembly was sufficient. 2 Corinthians 2:10, "To whom you forgive anything, I forgive also. For if I forgive anything, to whom I forgave it, for your sakes forgave I it in the presence of Christ, lest Satan should get an advantage of us, for we are not ignorant of his devices." The actions of the congregation to expel the sinner, to let the secular world deal with him, were an edifying factor, because the man repented and returned from being an adversary back to being a member of the body of Christ.
Yay!
When we stray from the way, we become little Satans. We become adversaries to Yahweh, to our fellowship, and our society. If a sinner repents and we don't forgive, unforgiveness can provide an opportunity to sow discord, despair, and division within the church. By being unforgiving, the community might inadvertently play into the role of a Satan, an adversary, which disrupts the unity and spiritual health of believers. Paul begins by emphasizing the divine mercy that has granted him the ministry of the renewed covenant, which motivates him to persevere without losing heart. 2 Corinthians 4:1. "Therefore, seeing we have this ministry, as we have received mercy, we faint not, but have renounced the hidden things of dishonesty, not walking in craftiness, nor handling the word of God deceitfully, but by manifestation of the truth, commending ourselves to every man's conscience in the sight of God. But if our gospel be hid, it is hid to them that are lost, in whom the God of this world has blinded the minds of them which believe not, lest the light of the glorious gospel of Christ, who is the image of God, should shine unto them." In these verses, Paul addresses the reality that the gospel is veiled to some individuals. He explains that this veiling occurs among those who are perishing, whose minds have been blinded by the God of this world. This blindness results from individuals' voluntary embrace of darkness and sin. By yielding to their own lusts and temptations, they obscure their understanding and harden their hearts against the gospel's message. The light of the gospel refers to the revelation of God's glory in Christ. Satan's, meaning the role we play's, objective is to prevent this illumination from reaching the hearts of individuals, thereby keeping them in spiritual darkness. The mind is blinded through various means, such as through belief in false doctrines, fostering prejudices, loving sin, and obstructing the light of the gospel from penetrating the heart. He draws a parallel between God's command at creation,
"Let there be light,"
and the divine act of illuminating believers' hearts to reveal the knowledge of God. Just as God created physical light, He also enlightens the minds of believers, allowing them to perceive His glory in Jesus Christ. This divine illumination transforms individuals, enabling them to grasp the profound truths of the gospel. The true blinder of unbelievers is God Himself. John 12:40, He has blinded their eyes, attributed to God. Romans 9:18, God hardens whom He wishes and has mercy on whom He wishes. Matthew 13, Isaiah 6, Acts 28, similar verses showing God actively hardening hearts. Early church figures such as Hippolytus and Cyril of Jerusalem entertained the notion that the God of this world could be understood as Yahweh God. Hippolytus, for instance, referred to the God of this world in contexts that aligned with actions attributed to God, such as the acceptance of Abel's sacrifice over Cain's. Similarly, Cyril discussed the concept of divine blinding, which some interpret as God's action to prevent certain individuals from understanding spiritual truths. The context of the passage, its background in wisdom literature, and its connection to Isaiah 6:9-10, suggesting that the hardening mentioned in 2 Corinthians 3:14 and the blinding in 4:4 might be actions attributed to God, serving as a form of judicial hardening. Hosea 4:6, rejection of God's law results in God rejecting the people. 2 Thessalonians 2:10-12, because they rejected the truth, God gives them over to deception. Romans 1:21-28, God gives them up to their sinful desires as a form of judgment. Psalm 81:11-12, God allows them to walk in their own desires as judgment. Matthew 13:13-15, Jesus confirms that some willfully shut their eyes to the truth. Acts 28:26-27, Paul repeats Isaiah's prophecy, confirming ongoing spiritual blindness. Romans 11:7-8, God blinds those who reject Him, fulfilling prophecy. John 12:39-40, God's judgment results in their spiritual blindness. Conclusion: these passages demonstrate that God sometimes blinds or hardens those who continually reject His truth as a form of divine judgment. This is consistent through both testaments, revealing a pattern of God allowing people to reap the consequences of their ignorant and/or deliberate rejection. Rebellion is rebellion, whether you rebel individually or just going along with the herd.
Just believe.
So, we saw earlier, when Paul closed his letter to the Roman Israelites, he gave them a solemn warning: mark and avoid those who divide the flock with smooth speech and serve their own appetite. These deceivers, like the children of Cain, slip into the assembly with flattering lies but corrupt hearts. Yet Paul doesn't leave us in fear. He gives a bold prophecy: the God of peace shall soon crush Satan under your feet. This wasn't a vague future hope. It pointed to the imminent fall of the Edomite priesthood in 70 AD. Their system was destroyed, their power broken, and the faithful prevailed. It's a reminder that the true battle is within, between the spirit and the flesh, and those created for honor will overcome the devil inside.
Devil inside, the devil inside, every single one of us, the devil inside.
Yeah.
You must rule over it.